The curious history of dating reveals as much about society's values as it does about the human heart. This fascinating chronicle traces how we've sought connection across centuries, from Victorian fan language to smartphone apps, from chaperone tea parties to Tinder hookups. Beyond mere romantic trivia, it offers a mirror reflecting our evolving attitudes toward gender, sexuality, class, and technology. Particularly popular among social historians and relationship psychologists, this book has found fans in celebrities like Emma Watson, who cited it as inspiration for understanding historical context in her He for She campaign. Its cultural impact extends beyond academia, influencing everything from period dramas to modern dating advice columns, making visible the invisible threads connecting our romantic past to present practices. In late 18th century England, finding a spouse was serious business, especially for the wealthy. By 1786, posting Lonely Hearts advertisements in the Times was already an established method for bachelors seeking wives. While Georgian appearances might seem excessively formal to modern eyes, both men and women paid careful attention to their presentation. Men abandoned wigs and knee breeches for long trousers and form-fitting coats, though some, dandies, maintained flamboyant styles, sometimes taking longer to prepare than their female counterparts. Courtship rituals were heavily regulated affairs. Men and women required formal introductions before speaking. Women could only speak when approached first, and chaperones were mandatory at social events. At balls, strict etiquette dictated that women must dance with everyone who asked, or no one at all, with minimal physical contact permitted. In this highly controlled environment, subtle forms of communication flourished. Fan language developed as a secret code for flirtation, with specific movements indicating everything from yes and no to more intimate messages like, "You make kiss me," or "I love you." Correspondence between potential couples followed equally strict protocols. Suitors needed to impress both the woman and her father, demonstrating worthy character and financial stability. Marriage itself required either bands read in church or a special license, with the 1753 Marriage Act ending secret fleet marriages that had previously allowed clandestine unions. For those unable to marry legally in England, eloping to Gretna Green in Scotland became a popular, if dramatic, alternative. Despite marriage being nearly permanent, divorce required an act of parliament, affairs were socially acceptable among the upper classes. The aristocracy operated under different moral standards than the emerging middle class, with top mistresses commanding substantial incomes and social standing. This double standard would persist in various forms throughout the centuries to come, revealing how romantic customs have always reflected broader social hierarchies and power dynamics. Queen Victoria's marriage to Prince Albert in 1840 revolutionized romantic ideals across Britain. She proposed to him, despite it not being a leap year, and they shared genuine affection, setting a new standard for marriage based on love rather than mere convenience or family alliance. Victoria's passionate declarations about Albert established romantic love as not just fashionable, but royally sanctioned, fundamentally changing how Britons approached courtship. Contrary to stereotypes of Victorian prudishness, industrialization actually brought increased sexual freedom in more open discussion about relationships. As anxieties about sexuality grew, so did conversation about it, from beliefs about female orgasm being necessary for conception to fears about masturbation causing disease. Love became the primary consideration in marriage, with advisor John Maynard writing in 1866, "Rather refuse the offers of 100 men than marry one you do not, cannot love." This elevation of romantic feeling represented a significant shift from earlier pragmatic approaches to matrimony. Victorian courtship could last up to 5 years as middle and working classes saved for married life. Young women of good family came out into society between 16 and 18, attending royal balls to curtsy before Queen Victoria before beginning their husband hunting, which might continue for 2 to 4 seasons. Etiquette manuals offered guidance on everything from navigating class differences to calculating ideal age gaps. Half the man's age plus 7 years was the recommended formula. The elaborate ritual of calling cards served as the dating app of the era. Gentlemen left their cards with servants, and ladies had the power to return them or not, effectively determining which suitors could progress to actual meetings. House calls followed strict protocols. Men visited around 8:30 p.m. for precisely 1 hour, asked for the mother even when visiting the daughter, and ladies never accompanied gentlemen beyond the parlor door. Social events like tea parties, at homes, receptions, and private theatricals provided chaperoned opportunities for flirtation, with piano duets and page turning offering precious moments of proximity. Valentine's cards exploded in popularity during the Victorian era thanks to cheap paper and new printing techniques. From simple woodcuts costing sixpence to elaborate cards with lace, ribbons, and gems costing several shillings, Valentine's sending became a national obsession. By 1836, 60,000 cards were sent annually. After the 1840 introduction of the penny post, this rose to 400,000, tripling again by 1871. Alongside traditional romantic cards, vinegar Valentines emerged for insulting or warning recipients. Floriography, the language of flowers, allowed Victorians to encode romantic messages in bouquets. Daffodils signaled new beginnings, lilacs represented first emotions of love, and tussie-mussies, small nosegays, combined scented herbs with a central flower as tokens of affection, whose meaning changed depending on where the recipient held them. This elaborate system of coded communication reflected the era's simultaneous fascination with and anxiety about romantic expression. The Married Women's Property Act of 1870 upended traditional power dynamics by allowing women to retain their inherited lands and houses after marriage. This eliminated the need for dowries and allowances, making marrying for love more viable among the elite. Meanwhile, the Free Lovers movement argued women should be afforded more sexual satisfaction if freed from the assumption that marriage and children were their highest calling. Transportation innovations revolutionized Victorian dating possibilities. By 1852, England and Scotland boasted 6,600 miles of railway, with 507 million tickets purchased by 1871. Trains enabled lovers to meet across distances while placing men and women in novel proximity within narrow carriages and dimly lit waiting rooms. Though ladies-only carriages existed, women frequently ventured into mixed or smoking carriages, sparking moral panic about their safety, which seemed more a reaction to women's increasing freedom than genuine concern. Bicycles became the Victorian new woman's emancipation tool. Initially, women rode tricycles in full skirts with chaperones, preserving modesty while sacrificing freedom. When two-wheelers emerged, women abandoned chaperones and ventured out alone, much to men's chagrin. Even Queen Victoria endorsed cycling by ordering machines in the earliest days. Bicycles facilitated romance, with the 1897 Ladies' Cycling Guide euphemistically noting people pay surprise visits by moonlight on bicycles. Photography revolutionized Victorian romance. The 1860s brought cartes de visites, thin portrait prints exchanged as flirtation and collected in albums. Well-to-do women mixed celebrities' photos with friends and family, suggesting broader social connections. Erotic photographs reached peak demand in the 1880s, smuggled from French studios and distributed by England's first porn dealers. The 1888 Kodak camera allowed personal photography without studio visits, leading photos exchanged to appear in Lonely Hearts ads, which experienced a revival between 1870 to 1900 with 20 dedicated publications. Personal ads flourished in the late Victorian era, costing sixpence for 40 words in publications like Matrimonial News. Ads followed recognizable formats listing age, occupation, wealth, even financial difficulties, with working-class participation increasing by the 1880s. Marriage agencies emerged alongside personal ads, emphasizing discretion with commodious private premises for meetings. While heterosexuals gained dating opportunities, LGBT individuals operated in secretive isolation. The 1861 Offenses Against the Person Act removed the death penalty for buggery, but the 1885 Criminal Law Amendment Act criminalized gross indecency without specifying what constituted such acts. Oscar Wilde was imprisoned under this law despite being married to a woman. Anne Lister of Shibden Hall, known as Gentleman Jack, documented her lesbian affairs in coded diaries. London hosted secret drag balls, while alternative guides identified gay-friendly establishments.
The Edwardian era replaced Victorian romance with revelry, led by Playboy Prince Bertie, who maintained a bombastic social scene despite scandals. His circle attracted both Parisian noblewomen and American buccaneer brides, heiresses who found London society more accessible than New York's. These self-made girls brought strong bodies, good teeth, vivacity, and flirtation skills that English aristocrats with empty coffers found irresistible. Edwardian fashion demanded tasteful decorum despite the glamour of buccaneer brides. Women achieved the signature silhouette with S-shaped corsets, creating a pointer pigeon bosom, while hair dyeing and excessive makeup remained taboo. The Gibson girl look, sporty with exaggerated curves, proved controversial, seen as either stylish or threatening to traditional femininity. Men followed moderation in all things, wearing modest three-piece suits with minimal color. Dating venues evolved across social classes. Music halls became acceptable for good girls, with shows featuring actresses marrying nobility. Dancing exploded in popularity, with American imports like the cakewalk, bunny hug, and turkey trot, followed by South American dances like the tango. Lower classes courted at Sunday bandstand performances, while upper classes maintained the London season, where debutantes competed for Queen Alexandra's favor. At balls, men secured dance partners by writing initials on dance cards, with strict etiquette forbidding multiple dances with the same partner unless engaged. Despite romantic opportunities, reputation protection remained vital. Being cut, socially ostracized, was a real risk for those flaunting affairs. Working-class women in service faced even stricter rules. Nearly 40% were domestic servants, forbidden from entertaining followers, romantic partners. Punishment ranged from reprimands to dismissal without references, often leaving prostitution as the only option for those dismissed. Engagements remained highly formalized. Wealthy women suitors were duty-bound to ask parents' permission first. Men were advised to appear composed rather than obviously in love, and to propose in person rather than by letter. Engagement rings were to be handsome, serviceable, and worn on the third finger of the left hand. Once engaged, couples were expected to show discretion rather than selfish absorption in each other. The new woman emerged demanding education, economic independence, and sexual equality. She smoked, drove, wore practical clothing, and upended feminine expectations, even suggesting women might propose marriage. Despite public criticism, these women attracted certain men, particularly as they sought information about sex. Premarital sex was occurring, with contraception becoming available, rubber condoms in the 1870s, and soluble pessaries in the 1880s. As war erupted across Europe, dating norms were upended while Victorian stereotypes persisted. The sight of men in uniform sparked khaki fever among young women aged 13 to 15, alarming authorities as these amateurs pursued soldiers across class boundaries. Women were subjected to curfews and drinking prohibitions to control this behavior. In reality, this phenomenon reflected women's desire to participate in the war effort rather than mere sexual attraction. Despite censorship under the Defense of the Realm Act, soldiers and sweethearts exchanged thousands of letters daily. By late 1914, soldiers without sweethearts advertised for pen pals in publications like The Link and TP's Weekly. These godmothers of war corresponded with their adopted sons by the tens of thousands, concerning the Home Office about security risks. This correspondence led to the hasty marriage scare, where couples who had never met arranged weddings, prompting the Liverpool Echo to question, should soldiers propose to girls they have not seen? Wartime created new opportunities for both straight and gay relationships. Gay men could meet in London's Piccadilly, attend all-male parties, or frequent venues like the Golden Calf. Many soldiers engaged in same-sex physical affection without considering it homosexual, while military drag shows became popular entertainment. However, venereal disease plagued wartime romance, with over 100,000 soldiers hospitalized by 1916. Two women's organizations emerged to police public behavior, the Women's Police Service and the Voluntary Women's Patrols. Founded by former suffragettes Margaret Damer Dawson and Mary Allen, the Women's Police Service had interventionist intentions, warning both sexes about immoral behavior. The Voluntary Women's Patrols wielded even more puritanical power, wearing special armbands and patrolling in pairs. By 1918, they became part of the Metropolitan Police with full arrest powers by 1923. These middle-aged women patrolled London parks with lanterns, separating couples, earning the nickname Interfering Toads. In 1914, merchant seamen from across the empire settled in British port towns to support the war effort. Restricted to racially segregated boarding houses, these Chinese, Black, and Asian sailors formed their own communities, but mingled with working women no longer chaperoned by absent British men. They proved attractive companions, well-mannered, generous, fit, and available. Many formed secret relationships and started families, though they were often forced to abandon them when authorities discovered these unions. By war's end, there were over a million surplus women to every eligible man, but women's new economic independence and freedom from chaperones put them in a better position than ever to choose their own partners. Post-war Britain faced profound social change. Young men returned maimed, depressed, or shell-shocked, if they returned at all. Economic depression culminated in the 1926 general strike, making life bleak for most working people. Yet for the wealthy or beautiful, the bright young things emerged. Artists, writers, and socialites with devil-may-care attitudes who engaged in treasure hunts, car chases, weekend orgies, and all-night drinking. Fashion gave the bright young things stylistic freedom and notoriety. Flappers adopted short, bob, or shingle haircuts, previously worn only by prostitutes or nuns, a grave affront to femininity that newspapers warned would leave girls single. Clothes emphasized boyish figures, abandoning corsets and bustles for dropped waists and raised hemlines. Women with larger breasts bandaged them to achieve the fashionable silhouette, using devices like the Symington side lacer. The motor car revolutionized dating, allowing couples to meet across distances and escape local scrutiny. Asking a girl to brighten meant sex, a convenient seduction method. Parties were extravagant, themed affairs held in swimming pools and country homes, with London's 11,000 nightclubs serving as playgrounds. Young working women flooded cities as journalists, secretaries, and shopgirls, using modest but disposable incomes to forge identities beyond traditional roles. Free from chaperones and family oversight, they could pursue men of their choosing despite the depleted male population. Jazz became the soundtrack to their liberation, originating in New Orleans' red light district, with jazz itself derived from a Black American term for sexual intercourse. Dances like the Charleston, Twinkle, Camel Walk, Shimmy, and Vampire energized a generation eager to shed wartime blues. Church dance halls became respectable meeting places across the country, preferred by parents over parks where premarital sex might occur. Dancing was affordable entertainment at just a couple of shillings, with afternoon tea dances particularly popular among women who often danced together before men arrived. Even soldiers stationed abroad were advised to overcome shyness through dancing classes. Despite newfound freedoms, women soon discovered liberty had its limitations. Many turned to magazines for relationship advice, with columns like Mrs. Marriott's in Women's Weekly offering candid guidance. The prevailing message was clear. Single women could be short-skirted, short-haired, smoking, drinking, and career-focused, but future wives must be accommodating and sacrificial. Marie Stopes revolutionized Britain's approach to sex when she published Married Love in 1918, effectively the first sex manual. Initially rejected by publishers, it sold over 400,000 copies by 1923. Stopes advocated for conjugal pleasure within marriage after her own disastrous experience. Deeply concerned about working-class women's plight, she opened Britain's first birth control clinic in North Holloway in 1921, distributing her pro-race cervical caps. The 1930s marked a return to traditional courtship after the experimental, jazzmanic 1920s. Marriage rates rebounded strongly, with the average marriage age falling to 25 for women and 27 for men by 1931. However, poverty significantly impacted dating habits during the economic depression, with dating becoming a luxury few could afford. Fashion reflected changing social dynamics, with women's clothing becoming more modest than flapper styles, yet still asserting independence. Men generally continued to rely on well-fitting suits. While older generations viewed makeup as inappropriate, by 1935, the average Good Housekeeping reader spent over $15 annually on grooming. Women were increasingly adopting more practical, tomboyish fashions, reflecting their growing equality. Cinemas replaced dance halls as the prime dating location, with some 23 million Britons attending weekly by decade's end. Films like Gone with the Wind offered couples nearly 4 hours together, though censors strictly limited sexual content on screen. Meanwhile, sex education books became widely available by mail order, with titles like Ideal Marriage selling remarkably well. By 1939, Mary Oliver and Heather Jenner established Britain's most successful matchmaking business, the Marriage Bureau, charging 5 guineas to join and attracting professionals seeking respectable introductions. As the decades closed, the looming threat of another war would soon transform dating practices yet again. With the Second World War came dramatic shifts in dating culture. Romance remained vital for morale. Soldiers treasured bundles of letters and photographs from sweethearts, while Vera Lynn's sentimental broadcasts became essential listening. Military leave provided precious reunions, with soldiers receiving 7 days off every 3 months plus travel time. Despite hardships, social life continued. London venues like the 400 Club never emptied, and dancing became both emotional escape and legitimate excuse for physical contact. Women maintained femininity despite rationing by improvising, using gravy browning to imitate stockings and Vaseline for eyeshadow. Escaping knickers became common as elastic shortages forced women to substitute buttons. The arrival of 1.5 million American GIs into wartime Britain, dubbed overpaid, oversexed, and overhear, dramatically transformed dating dynamics. These film starish young men earned approximately $750 annually compared to British soldiers' $100, allowing them to shower local women with luxuries like nylons, chocolate, and cigarettes during Britain's austere rationing period. Cultural differences created both confusion and attraction. British women were charmed by Americans who knew how to dance, joke, and compliment, while GIs found English girls refreshingly passive and eager to please compared to American women. The military attempted to manage these interactions through orientation pamphlets while establishing over 200 British welcome clubs with pre-selected hostesses. Racial tensions emerged when black American troops arrived, with white GIs spreading harmful rumors and fighting over British women who, according to Barbara Cartland, ran after the black troops. Mixed-race relationships faced severe social opposition, with marriage between black GIs and white British women explicitly forbidden. When American troops departed after D-Day, over 20,000 British women applied to be American wives, while others were left pregnant and dishonorably discharged. By war's end, adultery was so widespread that one bishop proposed a blanket pardon, while divorces skyrocketed from 7,995 in 1939 to over 60,000 by 1947, leading to the formation of the National Marriage Guidance Council. Post-war Britain remained austere, despite Prime Minister Harold Macmillan's assurance that you've never had it so good. Dating was an expensive proposition for men, around one for a first date covering cinema tickets, meal, chocolates, and bus fare, with uncertain returns. As one window cleaner complained after spending 30 quid on a bird over Christmas and got nowhere. dance halls remained the premier dating venues, with 1 in 4 couples finding love there according to a 1959 Gallup poll. Playwright Stephen Burkoff vividly recalled the Tottenham Royal Dance Hall as Dreamtime, where young men demonstrated their skill as a mover, grace, wit, balance, and tricks through jive dancing, one of the greatest dance forms ever invented. The arrival of rock and roll in 1955, when Bill Haley topped charts with Rock Around the Clock, followed by Elvis's Heartbreak Hotel, revolutionized dating culture. This stomping, emotional music caused cinema riots and transformed romantic lyrics from lovelorn longing to short-term sexual excitement. Hollywood offered alternative romantic narratives through diverse sex symbols like James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, Audrey Hepburn, and Gregory Peck. Their characters navigated complicated amorous escapades while still pursuing happy ever-after endings. Films like Roman Holiday and How to Marry a Millionaire, depicting class-crossing romances, particularly captivated English audiences, for whom social mobility remained severely limited. Princess Margaret, the original People's Princess, embraced fashion trends like Dior's new look and became the first royal photographed in swimwear. Despite her privilege, Margaret's love life was constrained by royal duty. She was forbidden to marry her beloved Captain Peter Townsend because he was divorced, unless she renounced her title, succession rights, and income. Despite post-war liberalization, conservative values still dominated. The 1955 Exploring English Character Survey found 52% opposed premarital sex for men and 63% for women. Marriage rates soared, with the average age dropping to 22.6 for women and 25 for men, the lowest since the 19th century. The 1950s saw more candid discussion of premarital sex. Leonora Iles's boldly titled Sex for the Engaged addressed class differences in relationships and offered surprisingly modern advice about maintaining individuality while dating. The newly founded NHS supported the Samhlé Planning Association by 1955, with clinics dispensing diaphragms and condoms nationwide, helping reduce illegitimacy rates. Mixed-race relationships weren't new to the 1950s, but a 1950 UNESCO ruling confirming no biological danger in interracial marriages and the welcoming of Commonwealth immigrants created a more accepting climate. Nevertheless, discrimination remained legal. No blacks or Irish rental signs were common, and some dance halls still operated color bars. In 1963, two brunettes became unwitting symbols of the new morality. Elizabeth Taylor, whose affair with Richard Burton was deliberately publicized to promote Cleopatra, and Christine Keeler, whose affair with War Secretary John Profumo caused scandal not just for the illicit sex, but because her connection to a Soviet spy threatened national security. The 1960s revealed a stark divide between London and the rest of Britain. From miniskirts to Bond girls, the capital exported a frisky image worldwide. By 1970, Britain had approximately 50 serious communes where free love, once the preserve of the Bloomsbury set, had been revived by a new bohemian elite. However, most people still prioritized finding a respectable partner to marry. As contraception became more accessible, concerns grew about younger teens becoming sexually active earlier. However, Michael Schofield's 1965 research showed chaste kissing was usually the first heterosexual contact, followed by various petting activities, with penetrative sex occurring relatively late. By age 15, only about 1 in 20 boys and 1 in 50 girls went all the way. In the 1960s, youth clubs replaced dance halls as the premier meeting places, with membership reaching an all-time high of 204,785 in 1963. Taking your date home was crucial, either for furtive snogging or to impress parents. This practice mattered significantly. By the late 1960s, 47% of boys and 34% of girls had met their future in-laws within the first week of dating. Mary Quant's miniskirt became more than a metaphor for the permissive society. It tangibly impacted dating behaviors. most men had never seen so much everyday flesh, creating debates about whether women who wore them were suitable partners. Miniskirts could provoke family disputes and even legal issues. In Spain, police fined miniskirted tourists for offenses against public morality. The early 1960s saw a revolution in relationship advice with the launch of magazines like Honey, Jackie, and Fabulous, plus Helen Gurley Brown's bestseller, Sex and the Single Girl. Unlike previous guides, Brown's books celebrated singlehood in superlative style and positioned economic and spiritual independence as prerequisites for attracting quality partners. The sexual revolution wasn't universally celebrated. Many feminists viewed it as a male scheme to exploit women without commitment. Marian Faithfull admitted she only managed to have sex with the help of drink or drugs, while Time reporter Andrea Adam embraced sexual experimentation as part of my growth as a human being, as a woman, and as a feminist. A technological revolution in dating began in 1959 when Stanford engineering students designed Operation Match, using the IBM 7090 computer to pair compatible singles. Participants completed paper questionnaires and mailed them with $3, receiving printouts of matches' names and phone numbers. Within 6 months of its 1965 launch, 90,000 questionnaires had been processed, generating $270,000 in profit. The 1970s marked the true sexual revolution that the 1960s had merely prepared. In 1970, unmarried couples still couldn't book double rooms at Claridge's, yet The Sun published its first topless model and Germaine Greer released The Female Eunuch. This decade would see dramatic shifts in sexual attitudes, media representation, and relationship norms as traditional barriers continued to fall. Jackie magazine became a cultural force for teenage girls, selling over 500,000 copies per issue by 1976. While not radical, its chatty tone created a loyal readership, offering much-needed guidance when sex education in schools remained minimal. The magazine took adolescent relationships seriously, categorizing problem boys into types like the hard type, the lady killer, and the plain rotten type. Forum magazine offered intellectually sophisticated coverage of sexuality with political undertones. Launched in 1965, it reached tens of thousands of subscribers by the early 1970s, though typically delivered in discreet brown envelopes. Articles covered everything from impotence and group sex to the pill's risks, while investigating topics like hypnotic breast enlargement, anal sex, and women's brothels. Television's growing influence, particularly through shows like Top of the Pops, transformed sexual expression and gender presentation. When Mark Bolan appeared wearing glitter, working-class men across Britain soon sported shoulder-length locks. David Bowie's 1972 Melody Maker interview declaring his bisexuality was revolutionary, coming just 5 years after homosexuality's legalization. When Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch ideas spread through society, women were expected to embrace multiple sexual partners without attachment as rejection of societal norms. However, many women found this unsatisfying, and virginity remained highly prized. As teenager Chris Arthur recalled, his girlfriend would let me do practically anything I wanted as long as it did not involve actual intercourse due to a superstitious regard for virginity. Television brought sexual content into conservative homes through shows like The Sweeney, Bouquet of Barbed Wire, and I, Claudius, which attracted up to 20 million viewers with plots featuring orgies and incest. While drama received a titillating pass, serious examinations of sexuality remained taboo. Thames TV pulled a 7-part series called Sex in Our Time in 1976 due to concerns about showing women examining their own cervixes. In 1971, The Observer began running ads for Dateline, Britain's computer dating company that promised access to 50,000 potential matches. The system ran on an expensive IBM System 3 computer with questionnaires designed by experts. Founder John Patterson expanded into Singles Magazine and a travel agency before his death in 1998, when Dateline sold for nearly $1.5 million. Though associated with the 1960s, the pill's widespread social impact came in the 1970s, when Harold Wilson abolished prescription charges for birth control and Family Planning Association clinics joined the NHS. By decade's end, 8 out of 10 young women had taken the pill. Research revealed contradictory attitudes. A 1974 Forum magazine survey showed young women held anxious opinions about virginity, yet 3/4 of women married between 1971 to 1975 admitted to premarital sex with their husbands. Television brought sexual content into conservative homes through shows like The Sweeney, Bouquet of Barbed Wire, and I, Claudius, which attracted up to 20 million viewers with plots featuring orgies and incest. While drama received a titillating pass, serious examinations of sexuality remained taboo. TAMS TV pulled a 7-part series called Sex in Our Time in 1976 due to concerns about showing women examining their own cervixes. In 1971, The Observer began running ads for Dateline, Britain's computer dating company that promised access to 50,000 potential matches. The system ran on an expensive IBM System 3 computer with questionnaires designed by experts. Founder John Patterson expanded into Singles Magazine and a travel agency before his death in 1998, when Dateline sold for nearly $1.5 million. Though associated with the 1960s, the pill's widespread social impact came in the 1970s, when Harold Wilson abolished prescription charges for birth control and Family Planning Association clinics joined the NHS. By decade's end, 8 out of 10 young women had taken the pill. Research revealed contradictory attitudes. A 1974 Forum magazine survey showed young women held anxious opinions about virginity, yet 3/4 of women married between 1971 to 1975 admitted to premarital sex with their husbands. As the new millennium dawned, traditional media fretted over women refusing to commit, while simultaneously warning against mixed sex, soulless encounters without commitment. Despite Daily Mail panic about women leaving it too late and preferring loneliness, the interviewed women appeared confident and content with their choices. Marriage and motherhood were no longer primary dating motivators. The LGBTQI community found unprecedented legal recognition during this period. The 2004 Gender Recognition Act granted trans people full legal recognition, later strengthened by the 2010 Equality Act protecting those undergoing gender reassignment. In 2000, armed forces lifted their ban on LGBT service members. After conflicts with the House of Lords, 2001 saw homosexual age of consent reduced from 18 to 16. The 2004 Civil Partnership Act granted same-sex couples equivalent rights to married couples across the UK. By 2014, the UK government finally legalized gay marriage. Partnership rights secured, finding one's happily ever after moved to cyberspace. The dot-com boom exploded dating opportunities through social networking. Skype and MySpace launched in 2003, with users quickly repurposing the latter as a free dating service. Programs like Dating Anyone combed profiles for relationship status changes, legitimate cyberstalking. Facebook's 2004 launch raised the bar for romantic introductions. Broadband internet brought porn proliferation, raising new questions about fidelity. Is porn cheating? Became a regular media debate. Performance anxiety grew as both men and women felt they couldn't measure up to adult content. By decade's end, consensus formed that excessive porn consumption damaged core relationships. Neil Strauss's autobiographical tale of the pickup artist movement morphed into a handbook for awkward men seeking fail-proof tactics to use on women with low self-esteem. Techniques included sarging, actively cruising for women, the neg, backhanded compliments designed to make women crave positive attention, and kino, brief touching to stimulate desire. Despite being recognized as tools for men without charisma or social skills, the game sold over 2 million copies and spawned a sequel. Tinder, launched in 2011 by USC undergraduates Sean Rad and Justin Mateen, transformed dating with its game-like interface. By 2014, it had 50 million users averaging age 27 and a valuation approaching $1 billion. Its brazen efficiency, swiping left to reject or right to match, whittled courtship to Neanderthalic essentials, even spawning Tinderitis, repetitive strain from excessive swiping. Dating technology continues evolving beyond mere matchmaking. Teledildonics, interactive sex toys allowing remote physical connection, help maintain long-distance relationships. Virtual reality dating promises to connect lovers in other dimensional spaces. Most significantly, the internet has transformed how people self-define sexuality. Where once those with unconventional desires had to rely on coded messages in underground magazines, now anyone can simply Google their preferences, making non-binary love increasingly normalized. Transgender visibility through celebrities like Laverne Cox and Caitlyn Jenner has critically broadened our conceptions of gender and love. Media representations like BBC's Boy Meets Girl show trans relationships beyond pornographic stereotypes. This blurring of gender categories positively affects sexual equality, exemplified by CoverGirl appointing 17-year-old makeup artist James Charles as their first male spokesperson. Despite dating apps gamifying romance, bespoke matchmaking services are resurging. Yet no service can predict chemistry, though pheromones might help. The 1995 sweaty t-shirt test at University of Bern found women consistently attracted to immune systems different from their own. Now, Smell Dating offers a mail-order t-shirt service where participants select matches based on scent preference. While chemistry matters, online dating has become the norm and statistically reliable. An eHarmony study of 19,131 people found couples who met online reported greater relationship satisfaction and fewer divorces.